as we meet here over in the state office, a three-year plan to restore fiscal integrity to New York City is taking final shape. And I cannot think of a more appropriate or ideal forum in which to discuss what we're doing than here at the City Club. Because you've been a pioneer for many of the reforms which we are beginning to institute. We're engaged, indeed, in a grim and painful, demanding exercise. There's no comfort, no joy in what we're doing, because we're going to the limits of what we can apply to the city in terms of economies, and we're being forced to set aside, to some degree, our hopes and aspirations for this city. What are we aiming at? What are we trying to do? We're seeking a stabilized workforce that the city can afford. There must be fewer people in public employment. We want to do this through attrition. But if reductions must be made, they'll be made on a planned and definite basis, and we'll make management and productivity more than abstract terms. They'll be measurable, and we'll see them taking place. We're trying to avoid stopping construction where we can. But if we need the money to prevent a disruption of services, we will have to wait for private lenders to come forth before we can resume capital projects. We're going to have to make those cuts. Now, we didn't arrive at our present budget difficulty in a day, and it will take an extended period of time for us to bring it back to sound and manageable proportion. The plan we're working on is one for 3 years. It's a plan in progress. It's definite and substantive in terms of keeping revenues in balance. And this is the plan of the Emergency Financial Control Board that I chair, a board created by the representatives of the people in the legislature. It is not applied to the city in some form that is indeed an abstract. It is a creature of law. As such, it contains the unwritten mandate to see to human needs as well as economic ones, to balance the social needs of this great city as we have balanced the books in the city. And from this day forward, we will know where the city's money is coming from and where it goes. We will have a system of regular monitoring, so the problems will no longer build unnoticed, so that we don't find ourselves at the end of a fiscal year with hundreds of millions of dollars in expenses for which we didn't plan and for which we cannot pay. We will have an orderly phase out of the city's deficit with a reduction of costs on a 3-year basis. The first step, which we have already approved in the board, will eliminate $200 million of that debt on an annual basis by the end of this fiscal year. We will have improved management techniques in every agency of the city, along with higher levels of productivity. And that's within the city's tax levy agencies and in the so-called covered agencies. We will look for duplication, overlapping, programs that don't fulfill their promises, and unnecessary expenditures. But the city is not a private corporation. We cannot make sharp shifts in policy without dislocating thousands of lives. In the process of restoring fiscal integrity to New York, we will not forget our responsibility to our citizens. And as long as I am governor of this state, the health and safety of the people and the needs of the poor, whether in the city or the state, will not be blindly sacrificed in the name of a balance sheet. That's not the way New York does business. There need be no conflict between responsive government and responsible government. We've already proven that. When I spoke to you before taking office last year, I had little reason to suspect or even imagine that the Urban Development Corporation was so close to bankruptcy. It was a good idea, run badly by previous administrations, and we could have self-righteously let it go down the drain. But vital construction would have been halted, public institutions stopped, homes for people, revitalized downtown areas for cities with high unemployment rates, all that would have been lost. So we brought good people and good ideas together and put UDC back on its feet, and it's going to succeed. And I must say that Dick Ravitch was an indispensable person in that regard. Now can we do the same for New York City and not let that go down the drain? Well, the same good ideas and the same good people are still here. And the same ingenuity and concern that has always been the strength of the city are present. I believe if we are given the chance by the federal government, we can bring New York City back to fiscal health and stability. There have been criticisms about the new management committees that we formed, so many of them, review committees, management committees, productivity committees. There have been charges that they're just another level of the same old bureaucracies. And that isn't true. These were created because we were tired of good proposals made by groups such as yours, sitting on shelves, collecting dust, never given the responsibility for putting them into application, and with no one reading them and doing anything about good ideas. Well, now the committees are there so that someone is accountable to us to tell us what reforms will work and which won't, and to have the responsibility of analysis so that we can know which cuts will hurt more, which cuts will not be bearable, which will provide better service in the end if we apply our programs and our resources wisely and effectively. They are there for you of the City Club and every other interested group concerned with the future of our city to look at and to bring to us and to work with us. The kind of change that must come about if we are to reestablish New York as a viable metropolis, a regional leader, must be far-reaching and more dramatic than any we have seen before. To achieve such drastic reorganization requires the participation of everyone: unions, community people, the business community, leadership in every walk of life. The Emergency Financial Control Board is a result, indeed, of a shotgun wedding, one of necessity. We've been criticized for being remote, for hurting home rule, for dismantling the process of democracy. Well, to some degree, indeed, yes. We have done some of these things, but to the least degree possible. In order to stave off the further dismantling and elimination of these processes, which default would surely bring. When the President and his Secretary of the Treasury offer derision instead of decision and a promise of no help, let them remember, if anyone is going to be isolated or elitist in this country, it is they who sacrificed millions in their attempt to punish a handful. This is a time of uncertainty, speculation, but it need not be one of despair. People across the country are looking for a sign of hope, a sign of positive direction in an increasingly negative world. Well, we have one that's here, and I don't want to be trite, and I don't want to be, in a sense, abstract, but it is here. It's the Statue of Liberty. It's the promise her lamp holds out that no one can find in the direction of America anymore. It doesn't belong to us, but it's here for us to see and for the rest of the country to remember. The truth is, if we accomplish our effort, we may in New York be shaping the direction that is needed all over America. For years now, New York has enjoyed a preeminence in everything, and in some things we've lagged. In economic well-being, we've fallen behind. It was the keystone of the emerging industrialization of the Northeast when New York was moving forward. And later, we moved the rest of the country with us. But now, the Northeast generally is feeling the effect of competition from the newer economic regions in the country. Our plants are older, and in some instances, less efficient and less applicable today's newer technologies. Our labor force, because it is the most highly skilled in the country, is also highly paid and now highly unemployed. Our taxes are the highest in the nation, and with a declining population, we are losing some of our markets. In the last few years, we've been hit harder by the recession because we're losing jobs at a faster rate than the rest of our country. We're feeling it harder, therefore, than elsewhere. But there also is a structural change taking place in the whole United States economy. And in that economy, we are no longer in a strong growth position as in earlier decades. For the foreseeable future, economists do not see a resurgence of that growth. Just as New York enjoyed the first fruits of this country's remarkable burst of industrial and economic vitality, so too, we are the first to feel the pains of its readjustments. Thus, what New York is tackling today is precedent setting in more ways than one. We are not only setting a new style of government performance, if we do it effectively, we can be on the cutting edge of solving tomorrow's problems. Maybe that's why the administration in Washington, the Ford administration, is apprehensive, indeed afraid. They're not afraid that we will fail. They are afraid we will succeed and prove all their empty theories wrong. They are afraid that the misguided federal policies of the past few years that have brought us to the brink of disaster will stand in stark contrast to the positive, constructive effort we're making here in New York. And what do we seek from our government in Washington? We seek a backup, not a bailout, not a handout. We seek a federal guarantee which recognizes the value of our effort and that by itself will virtually ensure that we won't even need to implement that guarantee. Contrary to the popular impression, the federal government actually stands to save money by helping New York in an explicit fashion. It is only by sitting on their hands that the federal treasury stands to lose hundreds of millions of tax revenues if the city defaults. The federal position on no help is so untenable, so indefensible by any ordinary economic logic, let alone responsibility, that it would be ludicrous if it weren't tragic in its consequence. It is a policy that has refused to recognize the need for a federal program in response to welfare, which is a result of federal economic failures. It is a policy which has purposely favored unemployment, which always hits the cities hardest, as an ineffective means of coping with inflation. It is a policy that has crippled the Northeast, dependent on highly expensive imported oil, while the rest of the country has the advantage of price-controlled domestic oil as well as hydro and all other forms of energy unavailable to us. If you want to see the stark reality of misguided policy, what better place to look than our bland tolerance of a 10% oil increase from the OPEC nations when we have a glut of oil on the world market. And at the same time, we send them arms to make them strong. Why do we bow to the strength they do not have, accepting that they have that strength with our dollars and our technology and our resources? We need a strong, international, interdependent policy in Washington. And perhaps from that kind of example, we will have the same kind of well-balanced policy domestically toward our cities all over this country. We need new directions from Washington. We do not need new laws to make bankruptcy easier. We need the time to make bankruptcy unthinkable and avoidable. We do not need a Secretary of the Treasury proposing an 11% sales tax for this city, which would further erode the economic base of New York beyond repair. We do not need leadership that focuses on what we cannot do. We need leadership that focuses on the possible and on the positive. So in the spirit of New York, this port of hope and promise, the city of strong people who came from a tradition of challenge to their masses, tonight I challenge an unresponsive federal government. I'm glad to do it in a room where Jack Dempsey is present. Politically, you may wish to ignore us. That has been done before. In the tea rooms of Georgetown, you may deride us, and that has been done before. And through press spokesmen, you may attempt to misinform America about us, and that has been done before. But it is at your political peril, the peril of the economy, and the best interests of millions of Americans across this country, that in the end, when you turn your back and let us sink into the chasm of default, you may be surprised, because there's going to be a loud noise from New York, and we're not going to let this country down, and we're not going to let this city down. History will regard any act of indifference and hostility toward New York as immoral, as the act of men without vision, without hope. And in due course, all the nation will regard that act as cruel and short-sighted, the giving up of leadership. Yes, a bankruptcy in its own right, the bankruptcy of presidential leadership. If this city is anything, and I've learned it during my 5 wonderful decades of life in this city, it's a city of comebacks. And the news of the 1970s, I assure you, will be the comeback of New York. Comebacks, the comeback of Gil Hodges and the Mets, the comeback of Judy Garland on the stage of the Palace, the comeback of people in neighborhoods, the comeback to us of our sons from far-off battlefields. We're a city that always comes back, and we're not asking anyone to do the job for us. I'm asking New York, I'm asking all of you to help me, to help us restore this city to its proper condition. I remember the city in which I was born and raised and educated, and the city you have worked to improve and to repair. It's not necessarily a city of crime, of filth and decay. It's a city of growth, of opportunities, a glittering center for all that can be beautiful and indeed bold in America. It's an empire city. We have the headquarters for world peace within our borders, and what we do here affects the entire world. The financial capitals of the entire world, indeed, look to us for every sign and indication of our solvency, our stability. And what we begin today, and what we're doing in the control board, in the city of New York, in the state of New York, we will be talking about tomorrow. I'm going to Congress, as I've been before, to the Senate and the House, to state the case of our people to the American people. I know it's a good case. I know it's a sound case. It goes in the direction of making us pay our debts, bearing our burden, and then making the comeback that we all know is worthy of this city. I'll need your help. I'll need your help because it's difficult to change the mind and attitude of a president, but we've already made some progress. I think I hear the vice president saying something different. And if the president will now speak to the vice president, as we speak to the Congress, then maybe America can speak and say, we don't want New York City to go down the drain, because it's part of America. And when one part of America is hurt, we can all suffer. So let's have an end to the talk of suffering, and let's get on with the building of a great New York City. Thank you very much.
That's been a live speech from Governor Hugh Perry here at the City Club in Hotel Biltmore, where the governor has given a fighting talk to the assembled businessmen and leaders here. We're now getting some questions by Mr. Bert Marks, the president of the City Club. Let's go to the podium.
Rattling by some of our municipal labor leaders threatening a general strike. What are your plans to support the city in the event of a general strike?
Well, any strike affecting our city, of course, would be illegal under the terms of the Taylor Law, and I share the mayor's conviction that when the head of the Central Trades and Labor Council, Mr. Van Arsdale, spoke against the whole notion of a general strike, that this was indeed the spirit of leadership in our city. I want to comment that even though cuts have been assessed and layoffs have been had, let's look at the side of the ledger where the pension funds have been invested in the city. That's a good sign of cooperation from labor leadership, and we're asking them to endure the endurable, to cooperate with us, and a general strike would indeed serve the purpose of our critics. They would see New York in chaos and say it's not worth saving. So I speak out against the general strike on the merits, and as far as the law is concerned, as governor, I would enforce the law against any strike of that nature.
Thank you. Steve Savitz. Steve, you wish to come up here and to the audience?
Mr. Governor,
speak into the mic, Steve.
Mr. Governor, over the next several years, the major decisions concerning New York City will be made in Albany by the Emergency Financial Control Board. And it's inevitable that just as the decision about the validity of the agreement with the teachers union and so on has come to the control board, many, many other decisions will also come forward. Now, in the past, the mayor of New York has had a staff of hundreds to help him in his decision-making about such issues. Precisely how would you expect the Emergency Financial Control Board to discharge its responsibilities? Who will be doing the work and under what structure?
Well, number one, as the statute is written, it is not the function of the control board to set governmental priorities and governmental plans for New York City. That's the function of the mayor and the board of estimate and the city council and elected representatives. But inevitably and realistically, when we control the finances of the city, we do inexorably have contact with those who are affected by financial decisions. As a result, we've set a policy which began this week of having meetings with concerned groups to try and see how we can get the proper input from neighborhoods, yes, from those who wish to speak to us on the impact of our decisions. We'll be meeting with the so-called covered organizations, the Health and Hospital, the Board of Education, those who work there. We're going to try to, in other words, be an accessible board so that our decisions are not made in a sterile fashion. As far as the staffing is concerned, we have two key principals who staff the board. The deputy controller, by legislation, is the functioning person of the board who gives us the numbers and the facts as to the accounting and other statistical data we need for the decisions we must make. In addition, for the implementation of the plans that we are passing upon, first of all, the deputy controller is Sidney Schwartz, a very well-trained and very well-experienced and totally qualified person from the staff of Controller Arthur Levitt. And the implementation and the administration of the plans worked out at the board level will be carried on by Herbert Ellish, who has served in city service, in federal service, and private sector, and our staffing, to the greatest degree possible, while it will be a small staff, will be reflective of the population of New York City. So we will have inputs in the staff, and indeed we will review our decisions to the greatest extent possible with all affected groups. But we will not supplant the government of New York City.
Thank you. Michael Yeaman has a question. Michael.
Governor, you spoke about the Emergency Financial Control Board's monitoring closely what will happen in terms of the budget and the way it is established. What will you do if the guidelines that are established, the budget that is established, is violated by the city? If the mayor simply spends more money than the established budget, and this is not an impossible situation. You have it now, both in the Health and Hospitals Corporation, where budgets are established and being violated, and also in the Education, on the Board of Education. How will you impose if the mayor violates the guidelines?
First of all, people have not noticed, but the control board has taken over the accounts of the city of New York. We have the money. That's the first case. We have the purse, and we therefore can regulate the flow of money to any agency, including the covered agencies of which you spoke, the Health and Hospitals and the Board of Education. The measurements and the administration of the control board, program by program, will be monitored and metered. And we have the function of watching on a day-to-day and week-to-week basis that those who expend monies are staying within the parameters laid down in the financial plan. And we cannot in any way derogate that responsibility. I hold it as chairman, and the controller is a member of the board, and so is the mayor. And while there may have been covered agencies before that could run deficiencies and then draw down the city's budget for those deficiencies, there is no such thing as a covered agency where the control board is concerned. Every budgetary process, every expenditure, every excess or every misdirection of funds, frankly, will be a matter of addressed by the control board. And you may not have noticed this either, but there are penalties involved of a severe nature, indeed of a penal form, for anyone who violates the expenditure limitations laid down in the statute which created the control board.
We've been listening to Governor Hugh Carey answering questions following his speech here at the City Club of New York in the Hotel Biltmore. We've carried this speech live here. The governor spoke very strongly about the duties of the city and the state to put their house in order, and also about the role of the federal government and the Ford administration in coming to the aid of the city as part of America. This is Steve Flanders, now back to Harvey Hauptman.
Thank you, Steve. And Governor Carey still has more meetings of the Emergency Financial Control Board to be attending this evening. They've been meeting all day. He and Controller Leavitt, Mayor Beam, they have until midnight tonight to make some decisions on the size and shape of the New York City budget. And the governor took time out to address the City Club of New York. The deadline for coming up with that satisfactory amended budget, as we said, is midnight tonight.